This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I am your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Manner Companion Graded Reader Series, and Do Not Touch must be one of the most terrifying things to read in Braille. My co-host is John Paston, co-founder of Manner Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and would kill for a Nobel Peace Prize. This is our end of the year special, where we've gone back through all the interviews of 2020 and pulled out the top 10 stories. Sit back and get ready to laugh, reflect, and possibly shed a tear as you listen to the best stories from this year. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey guys, I'm John Pasden. I am in Shanghai, China.
Okay, John, this is our last episode of 2020, and what a year it's been.
Oh man, yeah. So what we wanted to do was take a look at all the stories that came out in the interviews in 2020.
That's right, John. The best stories from 2020. We've done a lot of interviews this year. So we went back, we listened to every single interview, and we pulled out like the best stories to share. So before we kick into that, we do have a review.
All right, let's hear it.
Got an email from Thomas B. Says, love the podcast. I'm going back to listen from the beginning. In one of your earlier episodes, you talked about nation's four strands. I just want to say I really appreciate the inclusion of points from academic linguistics. Learning a language is an enormous project, and there's a ton of conflicting advice on YouTube about it. So hearing what actual research and your experience says about L2 acquisition is really helpful. Thanks for what you're both doing. Well, thanks, Thomas B. We appreciate it. And yeah, we do like to bring in the academic research into this.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up, Thomas, because actually I have plans to bring that in more. You know, Jared's down. We're going to do more of that.
Oh, yeah.
We also got some emails from some people who heard our plea to look for Easter eggs. If you were listening last week, you noticed that someone asked about the Easter eggs, and I gave a few little hints.
Easter eggs in what, John?
In our books, our graded readers.
That's right.
The hint was that they're in the illustrations. You don't even have to read Chinese to get these, honestly. But anyway, Simon Richards, he wrote, don't despair, guys. I just listened to your most recent podcast and thought that I better send y'all a short word to let you know that some of us readers have noted and appreciated the eggs. Though I've honestly never gone through the books looking for them, there are a few that stuck out. Okay, so he found one in My Teacher's a Martian and two in Hua Ma. For his sharp eyes, he won himself a free t-shirt.
Oh, yeah.
And then Simon, he found something in Monkey's Paw. So Simon also won himself a t-shirt.
Awesome, guys, and congratulations. Hope you enjoy your shirts. Merry Christmas. So we won't be giving shirts out every time, but, you know, when we do something like this, hey, if you were one of the first people to reply, who knows what might happen.
Oh, and by the way, both of them chose the Speak to Me in Chinese t-shirt, which says, you know, 跟我说中文. And if any of you buy this shirt and people actually speak to you in Chinese because you're wearing it, we would love to hear about it. That's the kind of thing that we're trying to promote here.
All right. And then we have last quick reviews from Pan Xiaofeng, her Chinese high school class, Hayes. He says, thank you for teaching students how to effectively study Chinese. There's nothing more helpful than learning how to improve your study habits and learning style. Please continue making them. They're really great. Thanks, Hayes. And then Nina says, love to listen to you guys talk and teach about Chinese and methods on how to learn the language. It's super helpful and definitely making my learning experience easier and more fun. You're welcome, Nina. And Jane says, the blending of instruction on Chinese language as well as Chinese culture makes this podcast a pleasure to listen to. Aw, shucks. Thanks, Jane. And Liza, she says, it's awesome how casual yet detailed your conversations are. It really makes learning Chinese more digestible. The addition of fun Chinese culture keeps it from feeling like school and is overall super fun. All right, Liza, I really appreciate that. So guys, keep your reviews coming. We'd love to hear from you.
All right,
now it's time for the top 10 stories of the You Can Learn Chinese podcast of 2020.
Let's do this.
Now, before we get into number 10, we have an honorable mention.
Honorary mention from episode 28, Chris Max.
All right, so I guess a couple key milestones or key points in my learning. One was shortly after I passed the HSK-4, got like a pretty high score on it. And all my teachers were just like, wow, like you've only been learning for 7 months and you passed. And then one of my teachers, he just told me like, yeah, but you know, like you kind of sound like you're from Xinjiang. And like for was just like, what? I didn't even know what that meant, to be honest, at the time. So he explained, you know, in Xinjiang, there's the Uyghur ethnic minority, and a lot of them don't speak Chinese as a native language. So they tend to have, kind of similarly to foreigners, not the most solid grasp on tones. So I asked him, I was like, oh, what do you mean? He's like, oh, well, like, your tones are all over the place. Huh. Okay. Why has no one ever told me this? And he said, well, you know, it's kind of too late now anyway. Which I was just like, what? What do you mean it's too late? I've only been learning for 7 months. Like, anyway,
yeah.
I sat down with somebody and I was like, no, we're going to learn these tones. You're going to teach me. And everybody kept telling me, actually, like, oh, like, you know, your tones are fine. Like, they're like 60% there. I was like, that means 4 out of 10 of them are wrong, you know? So I sat down and I spent 2 months. 2 months where, like, I didn't learn any new textbook stuff. All I did was learn how to pronounce things.
Wow.
Get the tones right. Get the pronunciation right. That was 2 hours of class a day, and I would go home and probably do another 2 hours of practice on my own. And all my teachers were just like, well, you're insane. Like, there's absolutely no point. You're already, you know, comprehensible. But, like, that comprehensible doesn't sound that nice.
Yeah.
It just seems like, oh, I can understand you. But I spent those 2 months, and after that, a lot of people who hadn't seen me for 2 months were just like, whoa, what the hell happened? And that for me was like a big turning point, just because pronunciation, like, even though, yeah, like, you don't need to sound like a native, but if you have something that's closer to a native, people are going to be a lot nicer. Like, one, they're like confused and shocked, and two, like, they're just going to feel like, oh, like, maybe you're more like one of them, and they start treating you differently.
Yeah. So can you share any experiences where people started treating you different because you had a more native-like accent?
So, I mean, one of the things is, you know, a lot of people who come to China and start learning Chinese, one day in, they start realizing, like, Chinese people are super friendly. Like, they're going to hear you say, oh, ni hao. And they're like, oh, wow, ni zhong le shu de zhen bang. And, like, everybody's super complimentary.
Yeah.
But it started just, like, being a little bit more genuine. Like, you could see surprise on people's faces. And they would start inviting me to, like, all these other cool little places that seemed less like the let me show off my token foreign friend and more like, let's just kind of hang out and have a conversation.
So you're able to have, I guess, deeper connections with people. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, this is something that's been proven time and time again. It's like, yeah, you're totally fine talking to somebody that has a non-native accent. But when you hear your own, you're just like, oh, you're from the U.S. Like, oh, you're German, blah, blah, blah. Like, you get a bit more excited and, like, you're just like, oh, yeah, like, you're one of us. You're like me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love this story, Jared, because it totally rings true for me. Like, I had a similar experience. I wasn't quite as high level as he was when he went back and tackled the tones. But taking that extra time to really focus on pronunciation, it really does change the way that people relate to you. Yeah, it changes everything, honestly.
And serious, you know, you go back to episode 28 with Chris Max. He does speak some Chinese on that, or you can find some of the links on the show notes to his YouTube channel. This guy's got some rockin' Chinese. He sounds natural. And I think that's why, you know, he's done so well in connecting with Chinese audiences. So I think that's a testament to, like, discipline and focus on saying, hey, I'm serious about improving my Chinese and recognizing the important elements of the language. And he just took the time and nailed it.
Yeah, one thing I want to mention also about tones is that it's not a short-term thing. Like, it's not something that you just get out of the way in your first couple weeks of study. Tones are something that you're going to be working on for a while. It's your little buddy that follows you along the whole journey. So don't think of it as some vegetables you can just swallow and get out of the way. Got to keep doing them.
Number 10 from episode 37, John Gordon.
I was actually going to go back to law school. Started getting ready to do that. And then the guy approached me and a few other people and said he wanted to start a new company. Again, I sort of had the thought of, well, I could go back to school or I could start this company. And even if it fails, I probably would learn more in a year of doing this company, even if I didn't get paid anything, than from going back to school. So we ended up starting this company called New Channel. So I did that for 12 years. And I sort of started to have people contact me about doing television stuff. My principle was, if I haven't done it and it sounds interesting, I'll try it. because it takes a lot of time. But and if I like it, then I'll do it again. Otherwise, I won't. But I did one like almost like an American Idol type show or something like that, where I sang a song on the show and I won the like weekly champion.
Oh, nice.
There's some very weird and interesting stories. But that ended with a guy like coming down on a lift, like flying out of the sky with lift and handing me a golden egg for winning that. I won't go into too many more stories, but for that show, they just contacted me and they said, we'd like you to come and participate in the show. And I was like, well, but I don't really have any particular talent of them. I mean, I could do. And they're like, well, you can sing a song. And I was like, well, I can't really sing very well. And they said, well, we'll teach you. I think it's fine. And so I had the thought of just, well, I don't want to not do it because I'm afraid. And if I have someone teaching me for a few days, I can learn how to sing a song. And then I got there to the show and I found out it was totally fake. Like they weren't going to teach me. They were going to like film a scene with me with a teacher. Like, so I would have like 5 minutes with the teacher and then that was it. And so
they're going to dub you over.
Well, I was like, what am I going to do? And so I went to a karaoke place just by myself. And I just sang the song again and again and again for like hours and hours and hours. Oh, and then they didn't want to dub me, but they wanted me to do like a pre-recorded one and then like play that. That didn't feel honest to me. and so I didn't do that. But I think part of the reason why maybe I won the like weekly prize for that was that I was the only one who was actually singing at the show. So there were two other people who were singing. And then there was a set of twins who did the hula hoop. That was...
Okay. So maybe not the stiffest competition, right? Maybe not the stiffest.
And the other people who were singing were, you know, were just sort of like very obviously lip syncing. And then I ended up.
Now, John Gordon, he was a friend of yours, John, but we hit it off right away. This guy was super cool. And he had so many great experiences during his time in China. But this was like a lot of fun. I've met a number of guys who have been on like TV shows in China, but like he won the whole thing. That was like, super cool.
Yeah. So Jared, are you saying you've never been on Chinese TV?
Actually, I have. Actually, my son, Colin, has been on Chinese TV. He was on a very popular kids show in China.
I feel like anyone who's been in China long enough is on TV at some point. But anyway, John is definitely quite an amazing Chinese speaker, and he's definitely got the determination to succeed even at singing.
Number 9 from episode 42, Laszlo Montgomery.
Although I did visit in 1980.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I went out there as a student. You wanted to go to China back then. It was not easy if you were, you know, a civilian. There was only one way in. You had to get a tour through the China Travel Service. Good old Zhongli. So you had to go there. It was anywhere between $1,500 to $2,500. You buy like a 10-day, two-week tour. And that was how I saw China.
Wow.
1980. I'll never forget it. But that was only 4 years out of the Cultural Revolution. You know, I'd go hang out. I'd walk on the beach in the morning. The days that I was there, I got to know this guy, this old guy who had taught himself English. He was a factory worker.
Wow.
This guy was like, I remember this guy. I'll never forget him. Zhang Chunpei. He was a chain smoker. And he'd sit there and we'd be on the beach with the wind blowing. And this guy knew how to light a match in the wind and light his cigarette without the wind blowing it out. Good old Zhang Chunpei. And I had these great conversations with him, and we were followed by Gong'an people. I remember when I was talking to him in Chinese, he'd say, oh, no, speak English, because he knew that we were being followed.
Wow.
And I stayed in touch with him for years. And he'd send me lists of books that he wanted, you know, all classics and whatnot. And I'd send him all these paperbacks constantly. And I just love Chinese culture and meeting these people from China. I had so many friends in Hong Kong and Taiwan. This is for me.
I think it was really interesting hearing about someone's adventures in China like so long ago. Like China was so different then. It's hard to imagine. Just Shanghai changes so much in just 5 years. And so to go all the way back to 1980 and then to be able to make a connection, man, that guy must have been alive for so many changes in China. I don't know. It's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. And I think what was really impressive to me about that story is that guy that he befriended, I mean, he was like a factory worker and had like taught himself English. I mean, you don't run across a lot of guys like that or people like that in China. For people who may not be familiar with some of the history, like about the Cultural Revolution, I mean, you know, it was a time where, like, if you were talking or had connections to foreigners, you know, you could be in prison.
Number 8 from episode number 43, Eric Majerus.
And now I got to ask, so that your wife, did she grow up in America or in China?
Yeah, she grew up in China, Southeast China. Okay. She came here when she was 17.
But I assume she learned Putonghua or just standard Mandarin at school, right?
She did. She calls Mandarin a foreign language. So she grows up speaking Thai Chinese regionally. They didn't speak Mandarin where, you know, she was growing up, right? And they just spoke Thai Chinese there. And it's not like it's a small city. It's, I actually don't know the population. It wasn't even on Google Maps until a couple of years ago. I mean, you could just zoom in indefinitely and see the road structure, but there's wow. no name, right? But now it's actually kind of changing. Like just the last time I was there, my father-in-law was complaining that people weren't speaking Thai Chinese. It's just the social dynamic is changing. So he had used Mandarin to someone at the train station instead of Thai Chinese.
So then when you decided to, hey, we're getting married, you know, yeah. I want to be able to communicate with my in-laws, Cantonese, no. Your wife said, no, hey, I want to learn Mandarin. So what did you do to start learning the language?
You know, I was learning a lot of grammar and stuff, but I wasn't learning a ton of just conversation with natives besides my teacher. But it was kind of sitting at the dinner table with my father-in-law. So my wife would work evenings. And so he'd cook something delicious. And then, you know, he'd tell me to come eat. And then we'd sit there together. And if we didn't talk, it's just silence. So it's just kind of awkward. You just sit there and just dead silence, right? But he's super talkative. So I'd always open up something lame, like, you know, so how's the weather, right? And he'd always jump into it. And so that was kind of like a real fun moment that sort of told me like, hey, you know, this is kind of worth it. Like, I'm doing an awful job, but I'm able to talk to him about the weather. You know, I ask him about the food dishes, you know, and then he'd run to the kitchen and pull out all the ingredients and show them to me. And it was kind of comical because he's got a very thick Cantonese accent. So his pronunciation is something I have to like really try hard at, you know, because he's not a native Mandarin speaker either. It's sort of this hilarious battle of conversation, but we have a good time.
Yeah, this one really struck a chord with me because I've had a lot of the same experiences, like talking to in-laws and talking to other older people in China. It can be pretty awkward, but if you just talk to them about anything, then they're happy to talk. And I mean, the same is true in English, right? A lot of people don't know what to say to old people.
You know, what really struck me about this story, John, to me, it underscored like the amount of change that happens in China. This guy, like his father-in-law, he is a native speaker of Thai Chinese, and he'll speak Cantonese as well. So Mandarin is like more like a distant third language for him. And I think a lot of people may not realize that. And so he was used to even going back to his hometown. He couldn't just use his local dialect and language just to get around. It was like Mandarin Putonghua is taking over and we're kind of losing some of these local dialects and languages.
Yeah, it's also crazy to think like before the 20th century, China was so fragmented linguistically. They were united by characters, but people from different parts of China couldn't really communicate, or at least not well. And that has totally changed, you know, in 100 years.
Now, John, am I mistaken that even Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao, he didn't speak Mandarin, Putonghua?
He tried. Like, if you go on YouTube, you can find his speeches, and it is hard to understand him.
So, I mean, that's an interesting historical fact I think probably a lot of people aren't aware of.
Number 7 from episode 38. Finley Davidson.
For my first 2 years of uni, I was pretty lazy. I liked learning the characters, but I don't think I was getting much better at speaking. I did my first 2 years, and halfway through your second year, you pick your year abroad city. We had 5 options. We could go to Beijing, Shanghai, Hainan, Chongqing, and Chengdu. I went to Hainan.
Oh, good. I'm like, dude, knowing what I know now about China, I would definitely go to Hainan.
Yeah, so I went there because we got given the options. It basically said Beijing, Shanghai, they're the options you want to go for if you want home comforts. There'll be lots of Westerners there. Chongqing, Chengdu, they're the sort of middle options. You can pick them if you want to. And there you'll get some home comforts, but it won't be quite so big. And then in at the deep end is Hainan. There'll be less Westerners there. You'll get more interaction with the Chinese.
And it's beautiful. And it's like a resort.
And it's beautiful.
Town.
It's like a resort. So I reckon I went there as one of the worst speakers in my class. Our days were all the same. Monday to Friday was all the same. The weekends were free. Monday to Friday was 8 a.m. to 12 p.m., like 4 hours in the morning. we had class, which I, again, participated in, but I wasn't really wild about it. I didn't really enjoy it. And then I would go and play basketball on the university basketball courts, where you just jump into any game.
Yeah.
I'm a very sporty person. I love sports. I'd never really played basketball, but I just joined in. The games were 5-on-5, first to five, winner stays on. And there was hundreds of teams waiting on the side of the court ready to come on. It's the same everywhere in China, I've now found out.
You want to get some playing time, you better win.
Yeah. And then in the evenings, I would play football. But I did all of that with Chinese people. I very rarely played with the other Lao Wai. And so I just chatted to people. And I think I came back, I wouldn't say one of the best, but I came back a lot better. And that's where I learned to speak. I learned to speak in China, chatting to locals.
And sports.
Playing sports, yeah. That's the thing that interests me. I said I was bored in class, probably was quite bored in class. I didn't really enjoy it, but I love sports and I'll always...
Now, this guy, Finley, super cool guy. You know, this was an excellent story because this guy is now teaching Chinese. He's achieved a good proficiency in Chinese, but he was like the worst student until he found something that he could relate to. He found a reason, a hobby, where it allowed him to enjoy learning and apply himself and really improve his language skills.
Yeah, and this is a totally legit concept, task-based learning. Rather than focusing on the language itself, use the language as a tool, you know, that's what language is, and try to accomplish something, in this case, you know, teamwork, sports.
And it's just a lot of fun. I will say this, guys, if you are in China, go find a university, and I guarantee you're going to find basketball courts. And if you play basketball, just put on some shorts and a jersey and just go down there and hang around and you'll be able to find some guys to play some pickup ball with.
Yeah, maybe not everything is well suited to that. For example, Tai Chi is cool and all, but most of the time you just don't even talk. So you do want to find something which is a bit more social.
Number 6 from episode 33, Shannon Kennedy.
When I was living in Ireland, I lived in a house with 9 people and 3 of my roommates were from China. And all of my Chinese roommates happened to be on my floor. So our doors were always facing each other and we shared a kitchen. And I would constantly run into them. I'd go into the kitchen to cook my dinner. I was by myself. They would all be chatting in Chinese. And of course, at this point, I did start to enjoy languages. So I would say, oh, teach me something in Chinese. And they'd like, so that we'd get like this little paper, all sit around the table and they'd start to tell me like what their Chinese names were and like my first few words. And I remember them making fun of my pronunciation. Like I could not get the tones right. I could not get the sounds, the syllables right. Like everything was just horrible. And they would make fun of me for it. And the only Chinese word that I can tell you that I remember from this era was sui bian, because they were a boyfriend and a girlfriend. So the girlfriend constantly is like sui bian, sui bian, sui bian. So that was all I picked up from my Chinese roommates after, you know, almost 2 years of living with them, but that's okay. So then fast forward to October 2018. And at this point, I had completely lost touch with them because we were friends on Facebook while they were in Ireland, but obviously that's difficult to access in China. So once they went back to China, I completely lost touch with them. Their emails didn't work anymore. I work for a Japanese music company, and because I speak Japanese, Chinese, and English, they wanted me to go to kind of liaise between the three groups. So I was in Shanghai, but for whatever reason, right before I went to Shanghai, one of them sent me a connection request on LinkedIn. And I was like, this is perfect. Peter, I'm going to be in Shanghai. How far are you from Shanghai? They're like, we live in Shanghai. Yeah. So they decided to take me out for hot pot. And so we go. And of course, at this point, you know, I've been speaking Chinese for about 2 years. So they take me to a hot pot restaurant in Shanghai. And prior to this point, when I was living with them in the UK, like 100% of our conversation was in English because I didn't speak Chinese. So they had to speak English to me. And like, you know, I'd help them with their English papers, check, you know, spelling and things like that. And then when I went to meet them in Shanghai, it had been several years since they had been in the UK. So they had forgotten 90% of their English to the point that they were not comfortable using it with me. So that entire evening was in Chinese. And like we picked it up and just like hung out in Chinese as though it had been what we had always done. And I mean, that was huge for me because the language that you establish a relationship in is the language that the relationship stays in. It's really hard to change the language of a relationship. So that was like a huge thing for me, the fact that I was able to change the language of my relationship with my three roommates.
What was that interaction like?
I felt more like I was one of them. Like the whole time I was living with them, these were people that I lived with, but I always kind of felt like the odd one out. We would do different things together as a group. Like we even at one point, all of us went to Scotland together. We took a boat, but I still always kind of felt like the odd man out because, you know, they were most comfortable chatting to one another in Chinese and not in English. And when I was in Shanghai with them, you know, it'd been several years since I had seen them, but it felt like it hadn't been. Like we just picked things off where it left off. And then I felt like I was actually part of the group that time. Like I was involved in 100% of the conversation because they didn't ever at any point have to switch to Chinese to discuss among themselves what something was in English to explain it to me and then maybe give up or maybe not quite get there. And so there were these barriers between us in English that now that I was able to speak Chinese with them, there weren't any longer. So it just created just a completely different feeling.
I really related to what Shannon said about how you usually don't change the language of a relationship. That is so true. In fact, research has shown that. I've written about it before in my blog long ago. And so that she was able to do that and maybe even make a deeper connection. That's awesome. That's what we're all about, right? Learning Chinese. You can't always change the language, but you can definitely get better.
Just imagine right now, if you are really at maybe a low level and maybe even a non-conversational level in Chinese, you may have some Chinese friends and you can't really connect with them. Now, let's just fast forward. I mean, if you apply yourself, you really can learn this language and you can change the dynamic of that relationship by learning to speak Chinese.
Number 5 from episode 39, Terry Waltz.
Well, I'm a big, big proponent, obviously, of direct-to-text reading, cold character.
And explain that. What is exactly is that?
Right. Basically, when I was working at the StarTalk at the University of Hawaii, starting in 2011, I started looking at reading. And I was teaching oral language only. I was brought in to do TPRS for oral language. And I had a lovely lady, Christine Wogstad, who was a longtime Chinese teacher in Minnesota somewhere, who was doing the reading class. And a more dedicated teacher you will never find. She really cared about those kids. She spent all her free time trying to help them read, and yet they couldn't read. And I'm not a shy person, as some may know. And one night, you know, late at night in the camp thing, she's sitting at the table and I'm doing lesson planning and she's doing whatever. And she just sighs and she says, "Oh, I just don't know what to do. They have filled out this little form every day for 2 weeks. It was like a 4-week camp. And they still can't read the characters." And I said, "Do you want me to tell you why? I'm burning my bridges my first year. I'm this new teacher at this camp." But you know what? She said, "Yeah, why?" And I said, "Okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to write you a story. And it's going to be repetitive. And it's going to only use language that I know I have beaten to death in this oral class that we've had." Mind you, we're already 2 weeks in. I said, "I'm going to use only that language. And you're going to have them read just by looking at it. Don't teach them the characters first. Don't worry about sounds or stroke order or anything else. You're just going to point to it and you're going to read along and you're going to say to them, 'You join in when you're ready.'" She goes in, she points to everything. They start reading. She hands the pointer to a student. The student starts pointing. They keep reading. She sits down on the side and she just has this look of shock on her face. But then the kids get to the end of the story. And we had written it to be an episodic story, like, "On Monday, George did this." It's actually George Shangchun Yoro Baozi, which is a book now. We got through Monday and Tuesday, and we were out of stuff, and class wasn't over yet. And she's like, "What do I do now?" And I said, "I don't know. You know, what do we do now?" So she goes up to the whiteboard, and she starts writing questions, handwriting. Now, this is a woman who can actually handwrite characters from memory, unlike
Impressive.
Me. Yeah, she's wonderful. She starts writing questions, and the kids start reading them and answering them. And doesn't this one little stinker, as she always called him, this one little stinker says, "Shouldn't you have a duh in there?" And she was like, "What is happening?" This kid had acquired language in his head. He had this tiny little MP3 of Chinese playing in his head, and that told him. It pushed his reading. It had his brain tell him what he should be seeing next. And that's exactly how Cold Character works.
Now, Terry is pretty awesome. This story was wonderful. I mean, it's showing that, hey, if you were like, oh, I can't learn characters, maybe you're just kind of doing it wrong.
Yeah, this is something that comes up again and again in our podcast, often from learners instead of teachers. You know, not every method works for every person. That doesn't make you bad. And so it's great that there are teachers like Terry out there, which are trying to change some things. You want to be part of that change too.
All right, we've only got a few more interviews left, but it's going to be a real quick break for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion. And we have a new book coming out.
Oh, yes. You asked. Well, you've asked for a lot of things, but we're finally delivering one of these.
And this is a level 2 book.
That's right. And we've redone a classic Robert Louis Stevens book, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but it's called Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, this is one of the classics that in its retellings has had so many forms. So if you go and, you know, you look at different versions of the story, man, there's so much inspiration out there. And so we didn't follow any of them exactly. We did kind of our own thing. We definitely brought a fresh new take to the story that goes beyond just adapting it into Chinese.
So it's going to be available for pre-order. It'll be available in the middle of January. So you can go online right now. You can pre-order your copy, or you can just wait till it comes out.
Why would you do that, Jared? Why would you do that? Why would you wait? That's so boring.
So don't wait. Go to it right now. And you can go to find it at mannercompanion.com or in the show notes. Jekyll and Hyde, a level 2 Mandarin Companion Greater Reader using only 450 basic characters. Go get it today.
All right, now how about some more clips?
And number 4 from episode 36, Lucy Jacks Lax.
So the thing that happened in Yunnan for me and during that travel and that exchange was I discovered Minzu music, so ethnic music, Chinese folk and traditional music. And I have this vivid memory of riding a horse, through, I'm not sure where it was, but this big, beautiful open plain and all these Chinese people around me riding horses and one of them singing this amazing Chinese folk song just out into the ether. It was such a moment. It was a magical moment.
Wow.
And I heard Chinese folk music for the first time. And I went, wow, what is this? And I got really excited about it. And I think my friends weren't nearly as interested in it as I was. But to me, it was so different and it was just so beautiful. And I could see that that music had been written to occupy the space, you know, that it existed in. So in that beautiful open plain, riding a horse. So I came back to my university in Australia once that was finished and I said to my professors, so, okay, I'd like to start learning Chinese folk and traditional music because at the time I was studying a classical music degree, an opera degree, and my professors said to me, Lucy, there's no one that can teach you that here. We don't teach that here. You know, you can learn Italian and French and Spanish opera, but we don't teach Chinese music. And so I sort of went, okay, I'm going to teach myself and ended up sort of applying the classical method of learning music to Chinese music and wow. Sort of had to figure it out for myself.
You know, John, this story, it like struck a chord in me. It's like the power of music and language. When she told this story, I could just imagine myself on horseback in some ancient time and hearing the story ringing across the hills. You know, and it's like that's the power of like language and music.
Yeah, it seems kind of mystical, right?
You know, she even went on to chart her own course in university and you know, develop her own program because like they didn't offer it.
And let this be a warning to everyone out there. Chinese language and culture have a way of changing people's lives when they get really into it.
So true.
Number 3 from episode 49, Matt Sheehan.
Yeah, so I mean the first year was kind of that like typical like roller coaster first year of language study.
Mm.
My first month I got there, I had a job at this school and they kind of put me up in a hotel while they were supposed to like refurbish this apartment that they were going to put me and my fellow teacher into. But the renovation project somehow turned into a mess and then we're delayed and et cetera, et cetera. So basically I was kind of trapped in a hotel room for, I think about a month more or less.
Oh man, Oh, a Chinese hotel room by the
Chinese hotel room. I'm like washing my underwear in the sink every day, yeah. You know, because like I don't have a washing machine and the
so like normal Chinese life, right?
Yeah. So yeah, finally, when we had moved into our apartment after the hotel, basically all of the appliances stopped working. We couldn't use the toilet, couldn't use the sink.
Oh, no.
And my manager had called and said, hey, someone's going to come and fix your sink and your toilet for you. They're going to come at this time, you know, be there. And they came in and I saw them going in there and I thought they were trying to fix the toilet. And the next thing I know, they're just using a jackhammer to jackhammer through the wall between the kitchen and the bathroom. They jackhammered my toilet and my sink and they turned off all water in the apartment. And like, I'm at this point, I'm still totally unable to communicate with them. So I just have these guys came in to fix everything. They like destroy the bathroom and the kitchen, walk out with my toilet, walk out with my sink. And on their way out, like, I can't even ask them, like, when is this coming back? Like, when will I have water again? So it was kind of like total failure on the language front. And I had no running water or toilet.
Store your camera, store your toilet, store your sink.
Yeah. What the heck? And so for about a week, you know, I had to like basically like handle my business like in bags in the kitchen.
Oh, and my gosh. Like,
it was a bad, bad situation.
Oh, man. What do you say to that? That sounds like quite the experience.
Oh, man. I love this story. I mean, this is like, this is not just like a learning Chinese story. This is like a China story. And this is such a good one. Can you imagine? The workers just coming in there, all of a sudden they're jackhammering. And you know, John, right? It's like these buildings, you could be on like the third floor and someone could be on like the 50th floor jackhammering and you can hear it like it's just next door. I mean, it's like,
yeah, jackhammering is jackhammering. But I actually had an experience when I first came to China, like no AC, it was super hot. The toilet didn't flush and all that. But you know, this is a lot worse.
I know that like carrying his toilet and sink out the door. You're like, oh, are you going to bring that back? You know? You may want to go back and listen to that actual episode. It's going to be episode number 49. In that episode, he also talks about, you know, he was like going to give up on China after that. But then he had a great experience that turned everything around for him.
I think the funny thing is, even if his Chinese was good enough to ask, like, when is my toilet and sink coming back? Like, he probably wouldn't have gotten any kind of useful answer anyway.
Yeah, that's a really good point, John. These guys are like, I don't know. They're probably like, you know, he's got like a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And they're like, you know, maybe like next week or something.
You'll get it when you get it. You'll get it when we're done.
Number two from episode 44, Kaiser Kuo.
Yeah, so sort of as a cover story for being in China, I enrolled in Beijing Language Institute. That was in the late summer of 1988. And I made the mistake in my sort of placement interview of speaking as well as I could. I shouldn't have. They put me in a fifth year class and most of the others were Germans or South Koreans. And I still had like 100 characters under my belt. And so it's okay. They said here, and they gave me this gigantic box of 2,500 characters and words that I was expected to memorize. They said, you know, get through these in a couple of weeks and then you'll be on the same page as the rest of us.
Just a couple of weeks, you'll be fine, right?
Right, right. Which was just, you know, it was absurd. And so at that school, I connected with this guy from Arkansas named Sean Andrews. He was also a guitar player, also had a mullet. He was great. He would say stuff like, hey, Kaiser, I'm fixing to go down the Xiao Mabu. Y'all need anything? We started playing together, and one night he stormed into my dorm room and said, you know, there's these Japanese guys, and they're playing a concert over there, and they're terrible. Come on. And so we went over, and we listened to this Japanese band that played the same three-chord songs three times, and that was their set. And it was just
– oh, my.
And then, you know, Sean's like, you know, Kaiser, we got to show these guys what rock and roll really is. And so he introduced me to a Canadian drummer by the name of Phil Sachs, and then – I think it was that very same evening, two Russian friends of mine, a guy named Sergey and a guy named Dmitry, told me that they had found this music store in Liulichang, which is the antiques district in sort of southwestern mm-hmm. Beijing, and that, you know, he gave me bus and subway directions to it. And Sean and I, as soon as we got out of class the next day, just rode the bus and the subway down there and found the music store. And we sauntered into the place, and it was just, you know, full of amps and effects pedals and guitars and basses. And it was a paradise. You know, we couldn't believe it. It was all imported. I mean, a lot of it was just from people going down to Tom Lee in Hong Kong and buying stuff and just schlepping it back to Beijing. And Sean and I started a conversation with the guy who was the floor manager. And I started saying, look, we're looking to rent some amps and maybe a rehearsal space if you have one. He sort of waved us away and said, no, before we talk about any of this stuff, I want you guys to pick out some guitars and just, you know, play. Have fun. Mm-hmm. So we did. We started jamming in, and you know, it was just your standard 70s, 80s AOR catalog is, you know, Boston and Black Sabbath and Blue Oyster Cult and AC/DC mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And we drew this big crowd in off the street. I mean, all these people who were, this is a tourist area, right? So these aren't Beijingers. Oh. These are, you know, white. These are people who are, you know, in Beijing visiting. And so it was a real kind of time warp. And so these two kids with mullets are sitting there, sitting on amps and just jamming away and, you know, putting on a real show. And there's this crowd of people just sort of slack-jawed. Then the manager comes rolling out and he's this pudgy guy with real greasy, slick back hair. He's got, you know, like six rings on his 10 fingers.
Stereotypical, huh?
Lolbat. I mean, he was just, you know, he had sort of Jiang Zemin glasses. So he said to us... we thought we were going to get kicked out, right? And we thought that he was, you know, coming to shut us down. Instead, he beckoned us to the back room. So we go down this hall into his really outsized office with this gigantic mahogany desk. And he has us sitting there, like, weirdly, like, far from the desk. He opens a drawer and pulls out a bottle of some kind of baijiu, and he pours three glasses mm-hmm. of that. And then he pulls out these, like, really awful cigars, and he... ostentatious, not saying a word. He cuts and lights cigars for the two of us and gives us our drinks. Then he sits back down at his desk and he folds his hands. First, he says, does he speak Chinese? And I said, well, you know, a little bit. I'll translate for him. We'll ask him, do you want to be on stage next week playing music? And I said, you know, Sean, so he wants to know if we'd like to be on stage next week playing. And Sean turns to me and he says, Kaiser, you tell that man hell yeah. You tell him hell yeah.
So, oh, man. Kaiser is a legend.
I love this story. I swear, I've played this story for my kids like three or four times, and they're just like laughing every time.
I wonder if he's good at drinking his baijiu and smoking his cigar. I would have struggled with that.
You know, one of the things I love about that story is he talks about the producer guy bringing him back into the room there, and the guy's wearing like Jiang Zemin glasses, you know, and I don't think anyone, you got to go like Google a picture of that guy. You see, he's got like these square horn rimmed, like shady, like tinted glasses, and you're like
thick.
That just creates the caricature for me. And I think that's a great story on like how he had an impact there on Chinese culture. I mean, he started the first heavy metal band in China. That was how it all started. And if you listen to the rest of the interview, he talks about how he meets then who became the front man for their band. And he's still around today and they're still making music. So it's a pretty cool story. So go back to listen to episode 44. It's super cool.
And don't forget that you can also hear Kaiser in the podcast Seneca, which is a great podcast.
That's right. Seneca Podcast with Sup China.
Number one from episode 27, Jeff Lindsay.
I should say, one of the interesting things about China is so intensely diverse. It's not just that there are so many dialects and languages here and so many different minorities and such vastly different geography as you go across the country, but there's like entirely different culture as you go from the culture in the city to, say, life out in the farms and the provinces. One of our most profound experiences, and it came by being able to speak a little Chinese, was becoming part of the life, to some degree, of a farmer family way out in a small village, a village of 186 people.
Wow.
And used to be...
How did this happen?
So I was walking along the streets of Shanghai at lunch. So one of the great things about being in downtown Shanghai, you just walk out, go any direction, something interesting is going to happen. You're going to experience, see, you'll find a great place to eat or whatever. My first couple of years, I just loved getting out and just walking as far as I could during lunch when I had the time. As I was walking there, I saw this man who clearly did not belong. You can just see sometimes that the way Shanghai people dress and look versus people that have come in from the country, the immigrant workers. He looked like many of the immigrant workers, but he was dressed differently. He wasn't a worker. He was actually visiting, and with him was a son who was then about, I don't know, 12 or 13 years old, with one of the worst leg deformations I've seen. His knee bent kind of sideways instead of forward and back. It was a terrible knee problem. It made it so hard and painful to walk. Every step, it looked like that bone's going to snap. It just was painful to watch him walk. And I watched him walking and struggling, and they looked really lost. And I felt like I need to see if I can help them. And I said, that's ridiculous. Of all the people on the street, no one has worse Chinese than me. There's all these people around. If they need directions, if they need help, I'm the last one. I'm not the, you know. And I just kind of ignored that impression and started going back to my office. And I thought, no one's going to help them if you don't. And I thought, I can't do this. They're probably from the country. And in the country, they'll speak a different dialect. I won't even be able to understand them. And I thought, I can't do this. And I just felt I need to. That's weird.
Yeah.
But I yielded. It took me a while. I kept convincing myself that's stupid and that I couldn't walk away. So I finally walked over. This was by Yuyuan, by the garden, Yu Gardens, which is the most wonderful spot in the world. One of the many thousands of one most wonderful spots in the world that China has to offer. And I just finally got the courage, walked up to them and said, hi, can I help? That was pretty much it. And he answered back in a dialect that, and in the out in Jiangxi province, it took me a while to figure this out, but it sounds like hey will become hoi, and the ZH sound, like ju, will sound like do.
And oh, so, I've encountered this. Our Aish was out from Jiangxi province.
Yeah.
Ro was like lo. R's
were
L's.
R's and L's.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Now, R's and L's, N's and L's, Z's and D's, all sorts of things are different.
You got to transliterate in your head.
It
takes a while.
So I just couldn't understand what he was saying. And I thought, okay, this is hopeless. I just wasted their time and mine. And then a man stepped up, and a friend was with him who was at a university. And he could speak, you know, Putonghua, but he could also speak English. And he stood up and is able to help me translate and explain what was going on. And they explained that they were trying to get to a hospital and try to see if they could get an operation for the son's leg. And I ended up giving them my contact information, and the student gave me his. And we chatted for a minute, and I was just really touched at what a dismal situation they had. It was really, really painstaking. Yeah. And they would come back to Shanghai and needed help in navigating and so forth. And we ended up becoming part of their support network and helped them and visited them in the hospital when they came from surgery, wept with them when we realized the doctor did the wrong surgery, things like this. And we've been out there 3 or 4 times out in the deep Jiangxi province now to spend time with their family. We were just there last Monday, and it was when the father has brain cancer and his life is, they've had so many problems.
Wow.
The saddest day was when his oldest son, it's a long, painful story, but there was a suicide involved. And it was one of the most traumatic days of my time here in China because there were actually 2 suicides on that day. It was very dramatic. Another one happened at the building where I, in fact, it happened a few feet from where I was standing. I won't go into that, but a couple of painful experiences, but we're part of that family's life. They're part of our life, and they are forever part in our hearts, even though we're going to be moving away, to see and understand a little bit about life in the countryside. That when we first went there, it was about 186 people, maybe 340 pigs. Now there's 0 pigs. The virus that swept through and wiped out a lot of the pigs and livestock in parts of China has just been devastating to that town and that economy. And you see the poverty and the suffering and the challenges that people have while we have it so easy in Shanghai, the easiest place in the world to live, the safest place in the world to live, the most wonderful place in the world to live. And yet there are people not far away that are just struggling with such deep, deep issues. It's really sobering, but it is also wonderful to have those connections.
Now, this story was just really special to me, and I've known Jeff for a good number of years, and I actually knew just a little bit about the story, but not a lot. It showed, I think, to me, the power of like compassion and connection that was only brought about by language. And at that stage, his Chinese wasn't maybe as good to really understand all the details of what that kid needed, and that stranger who was there helped bridge that connection, but then after that was made, the relationship continued in Chinese. And going back and visiting their home, tiny little village, and just what the impact you can make in someone's life by just showing kindness. care and compassion.
Yeah, and I think it's a problem everywhere today, just the indifference to the suffering around you. But it's definitely very palpable in China and big cities like Shanghai. And I think it's really cool that even though maybe his Chinese wasn't the greatest at the time, just breaking the silence and like saying something led to other people getting involved. You know, sometimes you just have to be the one to take the first step and cool things can happen.
That sums up one of the themes in doing all these interviews. It's just that it's hard to know what the impact can be when we not just choose to learn Chinese or another language, but when we actively try to step outside of ourselves and make a connection with another human.
Yeah, and remember that you don't have to have a high level to kick off this interaction. You can start anytime. You can learn Chinese and then you can use what you know. Use it now.
So those are the top stories from 2020. And 2020 has been a heck of a year for the whole world.
Oh, man.
I hope that you applied yourself this year. And maybe if you didn't apply yourself as much as you want, well, apply yourself this next year. But I think as we're going to see in 2021, things start to open up. I hope that all of us will take more opportunities to use our language as a tool to build bridges and make connections with more people.
Laying the cheese on pretty thick there, Jared. And we wish everybody a happy 2021, and thank you for listening to us in 2020.
That's right. So guys, onward and upward.
再见.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, grandma, singer, shelf elf, light bringer, scone eater, sunglass wearer, downhill sledder, snowman builder, snowball fighter, stargazer, and that one guy named Waldo. You can subscribe in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannerincompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. And I'd like to thank every guest who has ever been on our show, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Paz. See you next time.